This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Every spring, they gather in the sun, a mix of veterans and rookies, full of hope and promise, playing out a uniquely American tradition. Last year's battles may be over, but the rivalries remain, the practice, the passion, and the politicking. While the Miami Marlins may have gotten off to an early 500 start this baseball season, the Florida law writing session already is more than half over. Guns, greyhounds, gambling, tax cuts, tuition, child protection. What's been accomplished so far? For whom? What's left on the agenda? How could it impact your life, your job, your paycheck, your bank account, your school, and your neighborhood? What do you want to hear out of Tallahassee as the final weeks of the 2014 legislative session wind up? Join the conversation here on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Email us at thefloridaroundup@wlrnnews.org or tweet us using the handle @WLRN. Sergio Bustos is the political editor at the Miami Herald. Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times joining us from Tallahassee, along with Gina Jordan from WLRN Miami Herald News. Let's start up in the capital city. Gina, surprises so far as the legislative session now is, 5 or 6 weeks in?
I don't know about too many big surprises. I think for me, the observation has been that this Republican legislature has been willing to actually consider some things that perhaps they would not have in the past. Marijuana, for example. There are bills filed about medical marijuana. I don't think anything like that would go anywhere, but they've given strong consideration to Charlotte's Web for children. That's a non-euphoric form of marijuana. And you know, that, to me, you have them talking about gambling, you have them talking about marijuana. This is unusual for this makeup of the legislature.
And certainly unusual given that we're in a significant state election cycle this year, moving into November 2014. Sergio Bustos with the Herald. Why is the legislature willing to tackle these politically tricky issues more than anticipated?
Well, I think, as always, in an election year, you're always, depending on the party, you're always looking for your base. What's going to excite your base? What's going to motivate your base? And I think that's why you'll see these kinds of issues taken on. And certainly this year, it's going to be very interesting when you've got a former Republican running against the incumbent Republican.
Yeah. Tia, but does medical marijuana excite the base on the Republican side? Does in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants excite the base for Governor Scott?
It does. That's one of the concerns about the medical marijuana proposal that's in the legislature. It was gaining steam, and then it slowed down just a little bit. And even some Republican supporters wonder if their colleagues are playing politics because they believe that, you know, the more medical marijuana is out there, the more that it will excite voters who may not vote for a Republican governor come November. But to your point about immigration, that definitely, I think, is a nod toward the state's large Hispanic population. And these proposals have been supported by Republicans because they want to send the message that they'd like Hispanics to consider the Republican Party the party that cares about them the most.
We'll dig more into those two issues and others in a moment. But first, Governor Scott began this legislative session with the big item being tax cuts. Talk about Sergio playing to the base in the Republican Party in Florida. Back in March, at a rally on the eve of the legislative session, Florida House Speaker Republican Will Weatherford pledged to give Governor Scott what he wants. He said that the legislator and the governor would get $500 million in taxes. And in fact, they're almost entirely there. $400 million in cuts to state revenues have been made. And the centerpiece, Sergio, cutting vehicle registration fees. Any anticipation that they're going to be able to fulfill the entire $500 million in cuts?
Oh, there's no problem there. I mean, to be honest with you, the agenda for Governor Scott was quite modest this year. You know, this equates to like a $25 cut for the average motorist.
Yep.
Now, there was a little snag in it that a lot of people sign up for the registration fee for 2 years in advance, and they're trying to work something out there to help those out because they wouldn't be able to take advantage of the cut. But no problems there. And again, this just speaks to Scott's wanting to keep it a kind of, again, a modest agenda going into a very, very difficult re-election.
And Gina, the ability to cut taxes, in other words, cut state revenue, comes thanks to a $1.3 billion budget surplus that Tallahassee has been greeted with. Where could the rest of that surplus go?
You know, that this is the first time they've been able to do this in, I think, 5 years. They've been looking at multi-billion dollar budget shortfalls for years now. So here they have this surplus. And there's been talk about four different sales tax holidays. I think that was in the House. I believe the Senate now is only considering one. But they were looking at offering sales tax holidays for back-to-school shopping, for hurricane supplies, mm-hmm. for gym memberships, and for one more. I forget the
for child car seats and bicycle helmets for kids.
There you go. So they were looking at that. The Senate has cut that down to just one back-to-school sales tax holiday. But those would be the big opportunities where we could actually feel something in our wallets.
Taxes have gotten the attention of two leading voices in education here in South Florida, Sergio, the superintendent of Miami-Dade County Public Schools, Alberto Carvalho, and the Miami-Dade College president, Eduardo Padron. Carvalho wants lawmakers to require only homeowners file property tax appeals, not allowing agents to do it. He says that that closing that loophole would bring in, what, $60 million additional dollars to public schools in Miami-Dade County alone. Is that going to get traction in Tallahassee?
I think it is. In fact, what had happened was some lawmakers had read a Miami Herald editorial about it and said lawmakers are to do something. And in fact, they're actually reacting to that. Very strange situation where someone can apply for an appeal of your property tax, even without your permission.
Right.
And that's what the law is trying to, that's the loophole they're trying to close.
Yeah, it's and essentially
that would save them quite a bit
a preemptive filing, and the agent would share in the savings if you as a homeowner are able to get and win that property tax appeal. Meantime, President Padron from Miami-Dade College has complained very loudly, Sergio, to your editorial board at the Herald about a quartet of Miami-Dade Republican legislators that he contends are trying to kill a bill that would be a 5-year halfpenny sales tax increase, providing $1 billion in funding for Miami-Dade College.
Yeah, this is always a very delicate dance that an institution like Miami-Dade College does. Because on the one hand, you have to be very diplomatic with lawmakers. On the other hand, he's got his own needs where he was saying he's got dilapidated buildings mm-hmm. that need serious, serious repair. But again, I think the story doesn't become the amount of money he needs, but it becomes the politics of one institution fighting lawmakers. It's not a good storyline.
And he's since not necessarily backed off, but he did send a letter of apology to the group, and some members of the group have also complained that the group letter was not enough. Meantime, the legislature is moving forward with a massive rewrite of child protection laws. Child welfare on the agenda and has gotten considerable attention thanks to the Miami Herald investigative series, Innocence Lost. It uncovered 477 deaths of kids who had contact previously with the Florida Department of Children and Families over the past 6 years. Prior to the Herald's investigation, back in December, Senate President Republican Don Gates said he wanted to stop the cycle in Florida of child deaths and administrative fixes.
DCF, left to its own devices, has lurched between crisis, trouble, solutions, crisis, trouble, solutions, whether Democrats have been in charge or Republicans have been in charge.
So Gina Jordan with WLRN Miami Herald News in Tallahassee, does the legislative response stop the cycle? Does it meet that standard?
I don't think we'll know until they actually do something. I mean, they've been talking about doing this for a very long time. It always comes down to money. Are we putting enough money into it? And is money really the issue? So I think they're trying to come at it from as many places as possible this time. Let's look at the education of the people that are working directly with these kids. Let's look at how we can make sure we have the transparency. I don't know. I think the short answer is I don't know, and yeah. I don't think we'll know until it happens.
Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times. Is money the issue? Is that the way that this this investigative series has been greeted in Tallahassee on the part of lawmakers, that more dollars are necessary? Certainly the governor has proposed $31 million in additional spending for DCF.
Absolutely, because I think there's widespread agreement that these reforms are needed and the reforms will happen. But when you reform something and say you're going to hire more people or require new standards, that means you have to put your money where your mouth is. And that's where it gets trickier. For example, I think the money to hire new child protection investigators is widely accepted. Mm-hmm. But others are saying, where's the money for prevention? Where's the money to help parents who have fallen into the system, you know, get the drug treatment and the resources to fix themselves? And that's where there's disagreement, and those things are still going to have to be worked out.
Setting the finances aside for a moment, Sergio, one of the other points of the investigative series was talking about the unification strategy from DCF and trying to continue to put kids back with their parents. Does the policies that are under debate in Tallahassee address that longer-term strategy that DCF has undertaken over years?
You know, that's gone back and forth over the years. I think right now there is a feeling of trying to think of the child first, and if that means taking them out of the family, then that's the decision. But as Tia mentioned, I think that the real issue is, okay, so you've made that decision. Where's the support to make that decision be the right decision? You don't want them going from bad to worse, or worse to bad, if you will. Mm-hmm. You want them to be able to take a child out and actually improve the situation. But if there's no backup support to help, either help the family that has been left behind to deal with whatever substance abuse issues they have, financial issues, whatnot, then it really is not going to solve the problem.
Sergio Bustos, political editor for the Miami Herald, Tia Mitchell with Tampa Bay Times, and Gina Jordan with WLRN Miami Herald News. Along with me, I'm Tom Hudson. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. And the Herald's investigation into the problems of the child welfare system that led to the deaths of those 477 children in the past 6 years will continue next week. WLRN partnering with the Herald to produce a live town hall next Thursday, April 17th, 6 p.m. at the Miami Herald in Doral. We'll have representatives from the agency involved, the Department of Children and Families. The legislature will be represented. People involved with a range of organizations involved in the Florida child welfare system will all be present, taking your questions and comments as well on how to better protect children in dangerous homes. It's next Thursday, April 17th, 6 p.m. at the Doral headquarters of the Miami Herald. You can reserve your seat via email at eventinfo@miamiherald.com. A little bit more here on the mid-session checkup with guns. A year ago, guys, Florida Stand Your Ground law was really in the national headlines with the Trayvon Martin case. George Zimmerman, of course, found not guilty. This legislative session, lawmakers have passed a warning shot bill. Tia, what's this about?
Well, that's an interesting question you ask, because lawmakers will say it's about Marissa Alexander, who's a Jacksonville mother, mm-hmm. who was convicted of crimes for shooting her gun in the presence of her estranged husband as well as her children. And her defenders have said that she was scared for her life, that she had been an abused woman, and that she was firing warning shots and that the system failed her. And so the bill is being, she's being the poster child of the bill. But it's interesting because even her case, even if the bill is passed, it might not apply to cases like hers, where prosecutors argued that she wasn't firing warning shots, that she was being reckless and endangering the lives of both her husband and her children.
This comes at a time also another gun rights piece of legislation is moving forward in Tallahassee, Gina. This is a bill that would allow concealed weapon carry during evacuations, including civil disorder, riots.
Yes. During riots and even during, say, you have a hurricane on the way and a local emergency has been declared.
Sure.
That would be a case where if you have guns in your house but you don't have a concealed carry permit, you would still be able to legally carry during those situations as long as an emergency has been declared.
What are the odds, Sergio, that you think these expansion of gun rights will find the support and find their way to Governor Scott's desk?
Well, if the Stand Your Ground fight was any indication, pretty much the legislature is going to go along with what the NRA says, because the NRA has long been a very powerful lobbying group in Tallahassee. So I don't see a lot of, opposition that could get enough opposition to stop it.
To stop this. So odds are good that at least they'll wind up on the governor's desk. Let's get to gambling here, because the perennial debate over the gaming industry and expansion here in Florida. This session has included Greyhound racing tracks and decoupling of gaming permits. The strategy of decoupling here kind of works like this, it would allow Greyhound Tracks to stop dog racing, stop the minimum number of dog races they currently have to hold, but still maintain the permit for the poker rooms and the more lucrative slot machines. During a 90-minute Senate Gaming Committee hearing on Tuesday in Tallahassee, though, it became clear this decoupling strategy could still allow track owners to move unused racing permits elsewhere to open up new casinos. Palm Beach County State Senator Maria Sachs.
I want to make sure that that when this becomes law, that we don't, that they're clean, that the amendments have absolutely no part of an expansion of gambling.
So here's the question, Tia. During this Senate hearing, minute one, did the panel, I suppose, know of this kind of loophole that was in the piece of legislation proposed? Minute 90, they certainly acknowledged it. Was this an oversight or something that that lobbyists and others were successful in inserting in the language?
I think it's an oversight, but it also shows how the process works. You know, even as they're sitting in meetings, they're hearing from lobbyists. They're receiving text messages. They're being pulled to the side. They're getting notes from their staff. So there's a lot of moving parts. And I think what happened was by minute 90, it became clear that decoupling Greyhound racing from gambling, which means allowing facilities to have the gambling without the racing, could actually allow those permits to be transferred elsewhere, which would expand gambling. And I think once that became clear, they realized that that wasn't something a majority of the lawmakers would want to go with, so it caused them to slow things down.
Well, we're going to quicken things up because the agenda still remains full for session 2014, as well as here on the Florida Roundup. Still to come on the program, beer brewing, marijuana, and in-state tuition for undocumented immigrants. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Florida's beer business is growing, and growing fast. It's the small craft brewers fueling this growth, which has fueled some big concerns by the big multinational beer companies. The small craft beer brewers have won support in Florida to sell a popular 64-ounce container of their beer, but at a cost. A Senate committee this week okayed that 64-ounce so-called growler, but it would require the brewers to first sell the beer to a distributor and then buy the beer back from the distributor before selling it to a drinker at their own brewery. So, do you drink beer brewed in Florida? Do you visit these tap rooms? Let us know at 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or tweet us using the call sign at WLRN. Sergio Bustos, the political editor for the Miami Herald, is along with us. Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times and Gina Jordan from WLRN Miami Herald, both ladies joining us from Tallahassee. So, Gina, this bill that did pass a Senate committee on Tuesday did give the craft brewers what they've been asking for the better part of a year, which is the ability to sell these 64-ounce growlers. But it also forces them to follow the so-called, three-tiered system to sell beer in the state of Florida. How's it work?
Well, Senator Jack Latvala was very unhappy about this. He's pushing his own bill, and he likened this to the craft brewers having to pay off the mafia somehow. But essentially, the brewers would have to sell their product to a distributor and then buy it back. It's really confusing, but it has to do with this three-tier system protecting the manufacturers and the vendors and the distributors. Mm-hmm. And so in that way, it does sort of follow the law and protect everyone's interest. But it'll be interesting to see what Senator Latvala does at this point. He's very, very unhappy.
Sergio, we did a program on the Sunshine Economy looking at this big growth in the craft beer industry, especially in South Florida. And it was clear that these craft brewers really rely on these tap rooms for cash flow for the business operations while they get their beer brewing business up and running. And the concern is that this piece of legislation would essentially end tap rooms for small craft brewers in the state of Florida.
I think this is always a fascinating kind of issue. I know it seems kind of all about the beer business, but it really gets to the heart of kind of the argument, the constant philosophical struggle between the right and the left. Mm-hmm. Where does government come in on regulating and dictating the marketplace? this is one place where maybe they should let the marketplace do what it does best. And I don't think people would be hurt by it.
Well, and one of the things that we reported in that program from a couple of weeks ago was this year, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, the multinational company that owns Budweiser, for the first time kind of switched sides and threw its support behind allowing the 64-ounce growler. Tia Mitchell, perhaps, was the cost for its support, the enforcement of the three-tiered system that Gina described earlier.
I definitely think they're coupled together for that reason. It's something, you know, the legislation has something that the craft beer something that they want, something that they don't want.
Yeah.
And but because of that, it also has slowed down, I think, both measures. They're both in committee. And we have to remember that there's only 2 weeks left. They're off next week. And some of the committees aren't meeting anymore. So I won't say they're on life support yet, but they're it's definitely not looking as good for that measure.
So odds are very long that this piece of legislation would go forward. The tap rooms won't get their growlers, but they'll still be able to sell to consumers on site.
If that
status quo,
pass.
Essentially. Status mm-hmm. quo if it's, it doesn't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. Yeah, all right. Meantime, also in sin legislation, marijuana, of course. In November, Florida voters are going to be asked whether or not that they support allowing a doctor to prescribe medical marijuana. But first, lawmakers have considered allowing the distribution of a very specific strain of marijuana to help children with intractable epilepsy. This is the so-called Charlotte's Web strain. Gina, why the support of this very narrow use of medical marijuana? And is this, as some may concern, a slippery slope toward a broader acceptance of it on the part of the legislature?
That is what I think a lot of the lawmakers will be concerned about this year. It's going to be controversial for their base. Again, this is a non-euphoric strain, and the parents that came and gave testimony to the committees, they were absolutely heart-wrenching. In some cases, their children were with them. Some children who have lots of seizures respond to nothing except this drug. And, you know, these parents say, look, our child was dying, and now our child is thriving because we're able to get this drug in, you know, in Colorado. So the interesting thing is that Representative Matt Gaetz mm-hmm. is strongly behind this. He grabbed onto this, and he actually convinced his dad, Senate President Don Gaetz, that this is a good thing. So it's been getting a lot of discussion, but it is stalled in committee, and this just might be one of those cases where these Republicans are too concerned about what it might mean to their base to step out onto this slope.
Yeah, Sergio, describe the politics behind this, even within the Gaetz family, Republican political family in Florida. Why this medicinal marijuana issue, and why now in this legislative session here in 2014?
You know, this began really last year with a very prominent Democratic fundraiser, John Morgan in Tampa, St. Pete area, who had a personal situation with this and felt that it was high time, pardon the pun, to get this done. And at the end of the day, he put his money behind it, and the amount of public support for this is really astounding compared to a few years ago.
Yeah.
I think there's just been a groundswell of support for this kind of legislation because of what's happened in other parts of the country. You know, you hear stories of families literally picking up and moving from one state and moving to Colorado because the medical marijuana is available. And I think everyone in the legislature knows someone or somebody, a friend or family member, who may be going through a difficult time with some kind of cancer treatment or other medical ailment, like the case of epilepsy of these kids, and they just see this as the answer, and the public seems to agree.
Sergio, that's a significant statement, right? You think that almost every Florida legislator who's spending time in Tallahassee over the next few weeks has some primary connection, perhaps, to somebody who potentially could benefit from medicinal marijuana?
I wouldn't want to have PolitiFact back check me on this because I know they're very good at it. So what I would say is I think everyone has gotten very clear messages, as Gina said, that testimony during that hearing was extremely emotional and right to the point.
Yeah, Tallahassee has certainly shown tolerance to deal with some of these issues, from marijuana to small beer brewers. Dwight joins our conversation here on the Florida Roundup from Pembroke Pines. Dwight, go ahead. Welcome to the program. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the beer industry debacle, basically. I don't understand why the beer industry doesn't look at the computer industry as far as the business model goes. You know, you figure these small local breweries, if they can sell, let's say, in limited quantities, these 64-ounce containers, if, you know, considering if they sell out of their limited product in pretty much a record time, you know, the beer the beer guys would say, hey, maybe we should throw some money at these guys and or absorb them outright.
Dwight, we've certainly seen that in other geographic locations where craft brewers have had a history. I know we've seen some small brewers in the northwestern United States, Seattle area specifically, that large beer brewers have taken a financial interest in. So, you know, that's where future growth comes, when an industry like the established beer industry has seen sales volumes flat in the United States. There's no doubt about that. It is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Tia Mitchell from the Tampa Bay Times, Sergio Bustos from the Miami Herald, and Gina Jordan from WLRN Miami Herald News along with us. I'm Tom Hudson. Join the conversation once you hear today using our call sign on Twitter at WLRN. A former Florida governor was back in the spotlight this week. Governor Jeb Bush continued his focus on immigration.
They crossed the border because they had no other means to work, to be able to provide for their family. Yes, they broke the law, but it's not a felony. It's kind of the it's an act of love.
An act of love, Governor Bush says. Comedian Stephen Colbert's alter ego on Comedy Central's Colbert Report took Governor Bush's description, though, as indicative of Bush being out of touch with Republicans.
He will be missed. Because Republican primary voters know that illegal immigration is not an act of love, sir. The only love going on here is the immigrants' love for American jobs, education, and health care. I say, if immigrants love their families so much, then why does my housekeeper never seem to go home to her kids?
All right, on Fox News, meantime, Florida Senator Marco Rubio generally supported the comments from his possible competitor in the 2016 Republican presidential race.
What that comment does is it shines light into what a difficult issue this is. Everybody who's here illegally is different. There are some people that come here illegally to take advantage of our system. There are others who didn't plan to stay but overstayed their visas. And then there are those who come to this country because they are desperate to provide a better life for their children. What he was calling attention to is the human element of immigration.
And that is playing out in Tallahassee as well, where Florida lawmakers are considering allowing undocumented students to pay in-state college tuition. Join our conversation at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. Do you support the idea of undocumented students paying in-state college tuition in the state of Florida? Are you an undocumented student paying in-state college tuition in the state of Florida? Let us know at the call sign at WLRN on Twitter. Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times, Sergio Bustos, political editor from the Miami Herald, and A.C. Valdez from Latino USA along with us. A.C., how does Florida compare to the rest of the country in the treatment of undocumented college students?
Well, hi, Tom. Nice to be with you. At least 19 states, and this was pulled from an article that was in the Hill newspaper in D.C., mm-hmm. At least 19 states, including Washington, Colorado, already passed laws banning or encouraging in-state tuition for undocumented students. So if you're looking, actually, as you were just talking about with marijuana, at Washington, Colorado, of indicators of trends, this is a perfect parallel. And, you know, there aren't 19 states right now with legal marijuana. If you're really going to make one association with a drive for change, then it only stands to reason that where this is already happening, it's just a parallel thing.
And Sergio, as the legislature is considering this, it came out during a committee hearing over the past couple of weeks that some Florida public institutions already are allowing undocumented students to pay in-state tuition, which begs the question of why does the legislature need to ask at all?
Yeah, it's been interesting that FIU has been one of the schools that has gone with it, along with Miami-Dade College. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a geographical thing. Those schools deal with a lot of different immigrants altogether. You know, but again, this is one of those issues that has been going around and around for so long. When I was a correspondent in Washington back in 1989, this whole issue was there, the whole Dreamers thing and, mm-hmm. and the like. I don't know when it's ever going to get resolved. And not to sound like a politician, but it seems like everyone is right here. Yes, they did cross and enter the country illegally, but yes, they're actually here for just trying to better their families, and the vast majority are law-abiding. Just one of the thorniest subjects, I think, in American politics.
A.C. Valdez, senior producer with NPR's Latino USA. Sergio's right. You know, all sides have a point here. There's no doubt about mm-hmm. it. And mm-hmm. there's a humanistic side, and there's a community investment, certainly in public education and of undocumented students. What is it those 19 states that have codified this in-state tuition for undocumented students done that maybe Florida has been unable to get over?
As far as what those other states have done, I mean, I feel like it actually, again, parallels the marijuana situation very much, where, you know, if you all, like Sergio was saying, if you all know somebody who's been affected by a health issue where this medical marijuana thing is actually making itself present in your life, chances are also very good that you know somebody who either has an undocumented relative, or especially in a state as Hispanic as Florida, with such a large immigrant population, I think it's something around 20%. It parallels also the struggle for LGBT rights. Hmm. When you consider that one out of 10 people in this country are not straight, that also begs the question, you know, is there... I feel like perhaps there's been an effort by activist organizations to make that point. People know undocumented people. People, you know, get their hotel rooms cleaned by undocumented people. People have their cars washed by undocumented people. People like Jose Antonio Vargas write in the Washington Post and the New York Times. These are people who are not unfamiliar to us.
But the argument that's being put forth by those against allowing in-state tuition for undocumented workers, say, listen, the rules are the rules. You're undocumented, regardless of the reason why, but you're undocumented, and it is what it is. State Senator Nancy Dietert of Venice was one of the five Republicans in Tallahassee in the committee who voted against the measure.
When you graduate from our public K-12 system, you're on your own. You're a grown-up. You're 18 years old. No one is depriving you of an education. We're just saying, if you're not here legally, please pay out-of-state tuition.
So, Tia, the response to the counter to that argument is what? It's up to the schools, and some schools are doing it and others aren't.
Well, the counter to the argument that Senator Dietert made is that a lot of the undocumented immigrants that would be helped by this legislation are children who were brought to America by their parents. Mm-hmm. And so Senator Latvala made a comment in committee this week that he would not want his own children punished for mistakes he made. So that's how some Republicans are saying, we're not saying that undocumented immigration is right. We're saying let's not punish children who became undocumented immigrants, not by their own choice. And that's a lot of the argument that's being made.
And AC, that kind of echoes back to the argument that even we heard again this week from former Governor Bush calling crossing the border because you may have mm-hmm. no other means to provide for your family an act of love.
Right. And I would actually say to further kind of walk down the road Tia was walking down, if you consider these children of undocumented immigrants brought here by their parents as functionally American, having spent most of their lives here, certainly many of them in their adolescences, you need to consider what it takes to get a job in this economy, and that is not a high school, that's not a K-12 education.
Yeah.
That is a college degree.
Yeah, Sergio, when you look at the economic stats and the odds of being part of the workforce with a high school diploma versus with a associate's degree or a bachelor's degree, boy, the unemployment rate for those with a four-year college degree is a fraction of the unemployment rate nationally as well as regionally for those with just a high school diploma.
No, there's no doubt that it's another step up the ladder when you get a college degree. I was the first of my family to go to college, and it's paid off enormous dividends both for myself and for society as a whole. You know, I pay taxes. I'm part of the middle class, etc. Again, I just don't see, I understand the arguments on both sides, but I don't see why there can't be some kind of compromise, some resolution, be it a guest worker program, but like even this college tuition issue, it really affects a small amount of people,
yeah.
But the amount of people affected, it's very big in their lives.
And Tia, we continue to hear kind of the moral argument on both sides. We've heard it there from State Senator Dietert as well as former Governor Bush. I mean, they're both trying to make a moral argument. Nobody's making an economic argument saying this is a cost to the state of Florida. The tuition difference between in-state and out-of-state is ultimately we're talking about peanuts when it comes to state finances, that this just gets down to playing to political bases.
Well, there is an economic impact because, of course, in-state students pay a lot less money for our public universities. However, the argument has been in the Capitol that these students are just not able to afford to go to college in many instances. Of course, then the argument also is the economic impact their degrees would help, kind of what Sergio was saying about once they get their degrees and they become productive members of society. And also, you know, you talk about the moral implication, you talk about the economic implication, but there are also, again, political implications.
Right.
The Republican mm-hmm. Party feels that it's losing its Hispanic support, and they're trying to come up with ways to get some of that support back.
Yeah, let's talk about that political support a little bit, Sergio and AC and Tia. 20% of Florida residents are foreign-born. We know that Governor Scott anticipates a significant political battle in the fall from a Democratic opponent, and the Latino, the Hispanic, the immigrant vote could turn the election. Is that going too far in terms of the importance of this in-state college tuition bill for undocumented workers, Sergio?
You know, it's one of several issues. It's the one that's the latest now, but I think what you have here is just to go from my own experience, you know, my family came here in the 60s when, and we saw firsthand the Civil Rights Movement and the impact of the Civil Rights Act. On the other hand, a vast majority of these immigrants arrived during the 80s and 90s and are still coming today. They saw a different America, and I think that makes them open to either political party. Mm. But it doesn't do Republicans much good when it appears as if the perception is the Republican Party is shunning the immigrant, be it legal or illegal.
AC Valdez from Latino USA, does it continue this trend of Florida becoming more of a purple state as opposed to a red state?
I mean, I like to think it does, and I think you see that reflection actually in the national media itself. You know, you had Bill Kristol actually on MSNBC completely dismissing Jeb Bush as a potential 2016 presidential candidate.
As Stephen Colbert did, right? In the Colbert
Report,
essentially.
Exactly. But then you have, you know, you have the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal saying exactly this. You know, the GOP's immigration allergy has become excessive when even expressions of sympathy are criticized. And I think that shows a real sharp split about what's possible, the ickiness of, the potential ickiness, I guess, of a Bush-Clinton race aside.
Yeah, that would be Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton. Is that what you're referring to here?
That's what I'm referring to.
Gotcha. Just in case you are hearkening back to 1992 and thought you were in a time machine there, for instance. All right. This is the Florida Roundup. AC Valdez with Latino USA is along with Sergio Bustos with the Miami Herald and Tia Mitchell with the Tampa Bay Times as well. Let's take a call here. Michelle from Miami is joining us on line two. Michelle, go ahead. You've got a comment and a criticism.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to say everyone there sounds very intelligent and in tune with what's happening, but I have yet to really hear you speak on the bottom line. The bottom line is, especially in Dade County, you know, classes only take so many students, okay? So if you have 40 classes and it's full, then that means that there are going to be many students who cannot otherwise get in. That's one thing. Who's affected the most, especially in Dade County, by these students being in to, you know, being allowed to come in, African-American students, primarily. That's the largest number. So regardless of, let's talk about the number of students in the classes, those who cannot get in, and I'd love to hear you speak on who gets scholarships. I think these students are also getting scholarships.
By these students, Michelle, excuse me, by these students, do you mean the undocumented students?
The undocumented students. They're getting a fair share. So they're getting some scholarships that otherwise would go to American students.
All right.
They're taking seats.
Let's talk about this, Michelle, and from Miami.
And the last piece is, let's talk about the Latin thing. Here in Bay County, if you're not bilingual, you can't get in. The competition is fierce. What are you doing for those kids? I'd like to hear someone speak about that.
Sergio, she brings up some interesting points about supply and demand of public education post-high school. The ability to meet the demand if presumably undocumented students were allowed to pay in-state tuition.
I mean, this is the crux of the problem, too, is you have the problem itself that both sides have very valid points, as this caller has. Now, I don't have the precise numbers, but I know that overall nationwide, I think it's like 50,000 kids could be or considered the Dream Act kids. These are kids who you have to remember, these are a lot of these kids were brought into the country by their parents illegally. They didn't actually come here illegally. So I'm not sure it's fair to kind of penalize them for the actions of their parents.
Well, perhaps not, but Tia, to Michelle's point, you know, do Florida colleges, public universities and public community colleges have the ability to meet the demand if the supply is moving higher?
Yeah, I just want to push back on that premise just a little bit. First of all, of course, with the community colleges, the Florida college system is, for the most part, open enrollment. Miami-Dade College is not turning anyone away. When you get to the state universities like Florida International and Florida State, they do have admission criteria, and you could possibly make that argument there, but then it becomes more of, I think to Michelle's point, there are bigger issues about socioeconomic implications, racial implications in college admissions, but the undocumented immigrants are such a small portion of the overall applicant pool for state universities. I don't think that really your issue. Now, there are issues with Bright Future standards and poor children and their access to rigorous course material to make them better candidates for higher education institutions. But again, I think it's a little bit misguided to put all the blame on whether undocumented immigrants would get in-state tuition or not. It's a little bit of a different argument.
AC Valdez, the caller does bring up an interesting point, though, about the crowding out of other documented and or fully native students of other ethnic groups that may not have the chance, have the opportunity if the in-state tuition for undocumented students goes forward.
Well, I'm not sure, it's not something I keep track of as far as, the capacity of Florida schools, but I do like to think that Tia has a valid point in the fact that this is such a small slice of the people that might or might not be admitted to these schools that it might not make that much of a difference. I can't really speak any further on that. But I also do feel like it does get to the point of who do you consider American? If these children are functionally American to you, aren't they worth the same shot as anybody else?
And the same kind of investment. Yeah, legislators will be hashing that out in the few weeks ahead that are left in the legislative writing session. It's AC Valdez with Latino USA. Thank you, AC. Great to have you on the program. Tia Mitchell from Tampa, from the Tampa Bay Times in Tallahassee, watching over the State House for us and others. Thank you, Tia. And Sergio Bustos,
political editor
from the Miami Herald. Always great to talk with you, Sergio. Thanks again for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Still plenty more on our agenda here on the program. This is Where. It's the poetry of our position in the Sunshine State. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. This month is National Poetry Month. WLRN, along with the O Miami Poetry Festival, are helping you discover your inner poet. If you've been listening for a while, you know about this. We're inviting you to think of that special place between the Palm Beaches and the Keys. Write a poem about it and include the phrase, "This is where," And you can submit that to us at WLRN.org. The deadline for our contest is 6 p.m. on April 21st. And the person who has been tasked with wading through all of this poetry is Mark Hedden. He joins us now from Key West, which I suppose, Mark, is perhaps as good as any place in the Conch Republic to examine the poetry of place in South Florida. What kind of common themes have you come across so far?
Well, a lot of people like sunsets on beaches. I know that.
And which is
we've
tough.
Had a couple poems about the Miami Heat. We haven't had, I think, the definitive poem about the Miami Heat and LeBron yet, mm-hmm. but I think we're getting there.
You know, the sunset poem is an interesting one because, of course, throughout most of Southeast Florida, you don't see a sunset on a beach unless you're
right.
in Key West.
That's true, but they keep happening.
They do keep happening because we're not going to let geography get in the way of good poetry.
No, you should run a poetic moment with geography. I'm
yeah, that's
sure
true.
That.
Pamela Mishkin of Surfside was one of those that contributed a poem to our This Is Where. Let's go ahead and listen to Pamela.
Hashtag This Is Where. I turn off the rehashed radio contest, pull into the 95 express lane, and do the math. If X equals 12 green parrots, 5 political scandals, 1 perfect cafe cubano, or 2,394 South Beach bikinis, then Y must always be greater than X, as in, y más. Why such annual insistence, I wonder, when countless weeks add up to anywhere? As I branch off the 95, soaring above sea level, and breathing in the 30 seconds of perspective. And this is where I see it. A million mango blossoms, ruddy and golden, blanketing the city as far as the blue line of the sea.
The beautiful imagery there, Mark. What struck you about Pamela's This Is Where contribution?
What I want from any poem is I want it to just kind of ring a bell in your head. I don't care, you know, how it gets there. And I thought that was great, getting from 95 to kind of rising above it on an overpass and kind of seeing the landscape for what it is. I thought that was a nice moment.
It's tough to get any elevation in South Florida to be able to get that perspective over the geography unless you're on a man-made structure like a flyover on I-95 or 595.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I just thought it created a nice moment, which is what you want from a poem.
Yeah.
Or at least what I like.
Jacob Herman from Miami submitted one called New World.
Woken rudely by a speed bump as the bus rolls through downtown, I check the time. 7:29. I'll barely make it. The bus slows to a stop with a snore, as if taunting my own lack of sleep. I grab my stuff and run off, my backpack banging and clanging behind me. The shops beckon with a breakfast I had to skip, and the $20 in my wallet yearns to fly out, but I power on, crossing roads with my heavy load until I reach it, my school, New World. I walk in, barely making it on time. Some might say that getting up at 5:30 isn't worth it for a school, but this is where my ideas come to life, where my brain can delete its filter and let go a flood of creativity, and that's what makes it worth it.
You know, Mark, what strikes me about this poem is it is a slice of life, the youthful slice of life, the watching every dollar slice of life that we don't always think about in South Florida.
Exactly. And also, I mean, I've read most of these by email, and I haven't heard these aloud, and a lot of these guys are really great readers.
Nice. Yeah. What kinds of things are coming in here as we approach the deadline over the next week or so?
Well, we've got a great one coming in. I mean, I can't totally preview it, but we've got a great one coming in largely about a movie theater that disappeared a couple years ago.
You know, we have seen some of those remembrances of places gone in South Florida because, let's face it, we do evolve pretty quickly down here in the sun, don't we?
Mm-hmm. There are a lot of poems about things that are no longer there. We had a great one about, what was it called, Gator Kicks Long Neck Saloon?
Yeah, yeah, out west.
Which was the other day, which is apparently where Donna Rice, you know, made herself famous, and there was an alligator.
From the old Senator Gary Hart days, you have to know your political scandals from the 1980s to get
exactly.
that
exactly. And you know, that's, if you can work that into a poem smoothly, that's kind of beautiful.
Absolutely. Mark Hedden is curating the This Is Where poems for us here on WLRN. He's based in Key West. Always great to hear from you, Mark, and keep up the great work. You can see all of the poems that Mark has selected on our website at WLRN.org. That is the Florida Roundup here for this program. We'll be back on the air tomorrow tomorrow morning, 6 a.m., or in a couple hours at WLRN.org for the entire program. It's produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor is Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. Thank you, Lorenzo. Florida Art Beat is next, live from Studio A, award-winning jazz pianist and vocalist Ariel Pocock. Be sure to join her. She's fantastic with Ed Bell. We'll see you Monday morning at 9 a.m. on the Sunshine Economy. I'm Tom Hudson.